maintain American hegemony, the hegemony of a very tiny ruling class of the United States, not of the people of the United States, over the world.
It's very interesting that Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick was heckled at the World Economic Forum dinner earlier this week with the European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde walking out. Lutnick had written in an opinion piece in the Financial Times earlier this week saying, we're not going to Davos to uphold the status quo. We're going to confront it head on. We are here at Davos to make one thing crystal clear. With President Trump, capitalism has a new sheriff in town. Yiannis Varoufakis.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? What he said to them was, we're not here to join your multilateral global order, which we Americans created in the first place, and you became beneficiaries of that. We're here to bury it. You know, Christine Lagarde walked out. But where did she walk towards? Back to Frankfurt, to the European Central Bank, which is steadfastly refusing to do anything in order to challenge the hegemony of the US dollar. Because, you know, here in Europe, we have manufactured a European Union and a monetary union for decades now in a manner that it was always subservient to the United States, always acquiescent towards the dollar zone, towards the authority of the Federal Reserve. Never, never did the Europeans try to create. It's not that they tried and failed. They never wanted to create a sustainable, independent Europe. And now they are running around like a headless chicken, bleeding around, in apoplexy, but without a plan. There is no European plan, for instance, for Ukraine. There's no. What happened when, President Trump orders the Marines to go into Venezuela and abduct Maduro, whatever one thinks about Maduro? Did they protest the violation of international law? No, because they, again, like in the case of the Board of Peace in Gaza, they thought that this is for brown people, for the people in the developing world. So this is, as a European, I'm far more cross with our own leaders here who, now protest. But it's too late.
I am very interesting to see a Jared Kushner giving center stage a PowerPoint presentation on what they would do with Gaza. No Palestinians included here. And President Trump himself saying today, describing Gaza as a beautiful piece of property, said he is a real estate person at heart. As we begin to wrap up your comments on what this means for Israel and Gaza and Netanyahu not coming to stand with his friend President Trump in Davos, concerned that he could be arrested for war crimes when he comes into Switzerland.
Well, that's the only silver lining, that something keeps him up at night. He's a war criminal and he should be kept up at night. But just to answer your question directly, what this Board of Peace plan for Gaza is the completion of the genocide. This is the logical limit of what Israel has been doing, to treat Gaza as a piece of real estate. Palestinians don't exist. They can only exist as servants, as in the same way that under South African apartheid, the blacks were tolerated only to the extent that they didn't choose where to live, that they were confined in bantustans, and they were beaten up the moment they asserted their right to exist and to breathe as human beings.
And finally, Yiannis, if you could talk about the latest with respect to Trump's comments on Greenland withdrawing his threat to impose tariffs on Europe, and what the latest is about these talks that he says, the framework of an agreement that's been reached with NATO on Greenland status.
Well, it seems to me that he's retreated slightly from a tactical perspective, from saying Greenland is going to be mine, like Alaska was sold by Russia to the United States. Now he's shifting to saying I'm going to have freehold. I'm going to have something along the lines of Guantanamo Bay, a permanent freehold or leasehold with Denmark. But of course, we will probably have to revisit this conversation tomorrow or the day after, because this is not a settled agreement.
We want to thank you very much for being with us. We're going to end with the comments of the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, addressing world leaders at Davos.
Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. Over the past two decades, a series of crises in finance, health, energy, and geopolitics have laid bare the risks of extreme global integration. But more recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons.
Yanis Varoufakis, we just have 30 seconds. Your response as he talks about the great disruption at this point.
A brilliant speech, a very good diagnosis of where we are, and a terrible recipe for what we should be doing.
Yanis Varoufakis, we thank you so much for being with us. A former finance minister of Greece, most recent book is titled Raise Your Soul, A Personal History of Resistance. And we will have you back on to talk about that book, co-founder of Progressive International. Next up, we go to Lewiston, Maine, where ICE has launched Operation Catch of the Day, targeting the Somali American community. Stay with us.
Blow, howling wind, beat on fragile heart. Opening your eyes won't tear us apart. This was the year our fathers fell down. And all that we once held, they broke upon the ground. And the crowds, they disappeared. The scaffold removed. And the circle was drawn around me and you.
By David Berkley. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Maine, where immigration agents have launched a new enforcement surge dubbed Operation Catch of the Day. ICE Deputy Assistant Director Patricia Hyde told Fox News they're targeting some 1,400 people and have arrested at least 50 so far. Reports of ICE activity have been concentrated in the greater Portland area and the city of Lewiston, Maine's second largest city. Both cities have significant Somali populations. School officials in Portland report attendance is down overall by as much as 20% in some schools. This is Portland Mayor Mark Dion speaking Wednesday.
Our communities feel anxious and fearful. They see this action as unpredictable and a threat to their families. Collectively and individually, we've done everything we can to assure them and that we believe in their right to be safe. And we've tried to direct resources their way.
Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin accused Maine officials of protecting criminals. For more, we go to Lewiston, where we're joined by Safia Khalid, former city council member in Lewiston, Maine, who became the first Somali American to hold that role when she was elected in 2019. She now leads an advocacy group called Community Organizing Alliance, which is responding on the ground right now to the ICE surge. Safia, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about what ICE is calling, I mean, the horror of playing on the seafood industry of Maine, Operation Catch of the Day? What's happening?
Yes. Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me. You know, the operation name that they're using is really dehumanizing. It is creating fear and intimidation among our communities. Parents have not been able to pick up their kids from school. They have not been able to go grocery shopping. The streets are completely empty. Downtown Lewiston is completely empty, especially our Lisbon Street, which is our main street area. No one is going to the stores. Restaurants are closed because people are really in fear, and we are urging people to stay home and do not open the door to anyone who they do not know.
And Safia, if you could talk about, for people who aren't familiar with the demographics of Maine, and in particular Lewiston, who's being most directly targeted?
Yeah, you know, Lewiston is home to a large population of naturalized Somali Americans, and you know, like Minneapolis in the Twin Cities, he is targeting Somali Americans, but they are also targeting the larger immigrant population here in the Lewiston urban area in the greater Portland area.
And have you heard directly from people who have been targeted? Have you been speaking to people on the ground?
Yes, we are on the ground helping folks. Yesterday, I was, you know, parents called me to get their kids from school because one parent, for example, an ICE agent knocked her door. They're going door to door here in Lewiston, of course, in other parts of the state. But when she opened the door, they said that they were police officers. They didn't identify themselves as a federal agent. They didn't identify themselves as ICE agents. They also had plain clothes, too. So they're disguising themselves as regular police officers. And when she opened the door, they immediately arrested her. Right. This is an older Somali woman. They arrested her in front of her kids. Didn't even let her get her jacket or prepare for anything, and put her in the vehicle and drove away. There's also another woman who was kidnapped from her home. They knocked the door as well. She looked through the window. She didn't see anyone. And then she peeked. She opened the door just a little bit, but they were hiding somewhere. And they immediately grabbed her and took her away. One woman was brought back to her home, but the other woman were still looking for her.
A growing number of U.S. citizens have been swept up by ICE as they surge enforcement around the country. I wanted to go to this Somali American from St. Paul, Minnesota, who says she was called a racial slur by an ICE agent before being pushed to the ground. This is Nasra Ahmed, a U.S.-born citizen with no criminal record, detained for 2 days by ICE.
I am proud to say that I've survived ICE. We were both crying together. We were holding each other tight. And I'll never forget, like, the fear that we both felt in our hearts that day.
She still has bandages on her forehead. And I wanted to ask you, Safia, how do you inform people of their rights when you get this latest information, the Associated Press reporting ICE is asserting ICE officers have the power to forcibly enter homes without a judicial warrant and what legal experts have said is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment? What do you tell people to do as we wrap up?
Well, the thing is, if a white woman was shot in the face, none of us are safe, right? We are trying to really just educate people as much as we can. We're telling people, do not open your doors. And people are scared. They say, I cannot stay home. I cannot not go to work. But we're trying to put some operations and some systems in place. We have partners in Minneapolis and in Chicago and across the country who have seen these attacks in their communities, and they have been tremendous help and a resource to us. So we're learning from our comrades across the country, but it is a frightening and a scary time for all of us. For us to urge people to stay home and do not leave your home, it's a scary time we live in.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. We are going to continue to cover what's happening not only in Lewiston and Portland, Maine, and Minneapolis and St. Paul and beyond. Safia Khalid, former Lewiston, Maine City Council member, who became the first Somali American to hold that position when she was elected in 2019, now leading an advocacy group called Community Organizing Alliance, speaking to her in Lewiston. When we come back, we'll be joined in studio by the internationally acclaimed Iranian author Sahar Delejani about the unprecedented crackdown and reports of massacres in Iran. Stay with us.
Oh.
Luthi performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Iran. The U.S.-based human rights activist news agency now says that since protests erupted on January 8th, more than 4,900 people have been killed, and that may be an undercount. A new Amnesty International report on lethal force used against peaceful protesters documented how Iranian security forces stationed on rooftops fired rifles and shotguns loaded with metal pellets, often aiming for the head and torso.
President Trump had repeatedly threatened to intervene if protesters in Iran continued to be killed. But speaking today in Davos, he claimed Iran's leaders are open to negotiation.
Iran does want to talk, and we'll talk.
Last week, a U.S. aircraft carrier stationed in the South China Sea began heading toward the Persian Gulf. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, warned Iran will be, quote, firing back with everything we have if we come under renewed attack. Araghchi's invitation to the World Economic Forum in Davos was rescinded over the killing of protesters in Iran.
For more, we're joined in our New York studio by Sahar Delijani, an internationally acclaimed Iranian author. Her debut novel, Children of the Jacaranda Tree. It's been published in more than 75 countries, translated to nearly three dozen languages since it was released in 2013. She was born in Tehran's Evin prison in 1983, after her parents, who were secular leftist political activists, were jailed by Iranian forces. One of her uncles was executed by the Iranian government in 1988. Her family migrated to California in 1996, 30 years ago. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's so important to have you with us. You're born in the Evin prison. You're here and now in the United States. As you look at what's happening in Iran, can you describe what you understand is happening? And if you see these protests that are happening now across the country of Iran, different from what happened in 2022?
Thanks so much for having me. I think what has been unfolding in Iran, of course, as you said, is one of the largest mass killings of protesters that we have ever witnessed. And the only thing that's comparable to it is the mass executions of 1988, where my uncle was executed along with thousands of other political prisoners, and all these bodies were just dumped into mass graves. Nobody was allowed to hold funerals, and the same thing is happening again. As you said, like, we don't even know the numbers of how many people have been killed this time. That number might never be verified, because just as the executions of 1988, we still don't know how many people were executed, how many thousands. And we all know that this is part of a long struggle of Iranian people to oust this regime, against tyranny, against dictatorship, against an authoritarian theocratic regime, a military state. And what has been, of course, the first thing that I can say is just this level of violence that the regime has shown. But another thing, which when the protests first started, we always had protests where they would start in bigger cities, in Tehran and bigger cities. And this was one of the first times that they actually started in very small towns. Sometimes I had never even heard the name of that town. And another thing that is also important to, I think, underline is that this is a working class uprising. These are people who are coming from disenfranchised towns. These are people who are able to make it to the end of the month. And this is not just a question of now. This has been happening partly due to sanctions, but also partly to this rampant corruption and mismanagement of the regime, and also because the Revolutionary Guards have taken over the economy from every point of view. So I think in so many ways, this is finally— These are the people who were never part of our narrative. We never talked about the working class when we talked about Iran. So this is now finally them coming out, and they're saying, we're here, and this is not what we want.
And could you explain, you just said this, the Revolutionary Guard has taken over the economy. Could you explain what aspects of the economy they have taken over and how this occurred over the course of these decades since the Islamic Revolution?
I mean, they have basically taken over every possible in commerce, in, pharmaceutical medicine. Like, there's just like even entertainment and restaurants, like everything. Like, you hear of people, and then it's like a mafia system, you know, and it's really hard to fight against them because people have very little power. And this has been happening for a long time, ever since this sort of, because we also have to take into account that this is a capitalist regime. It could be not as advanced as you know, the American one, but this is still a capitalist regime. So what happens is that over time, the military, the revolutionary guards, which were supposed to just guard the revolution in theory, just became stronger and stronger and stronger through the markets becoming free markets. And so this is now 35 years later, and this is we see the result of.
Well, you said earlier that this, at least it began as a working class protest and focused principally on the economic conditions in Iran, but then it seems to have become about many, many more things. So if you could explain all of the issues that people are protesting against, much, much wider than the 2022 protests. And then also you drew an analogy between what happened in 1988, in which your own family suffered so greatly, and what's happening now. What explains the brutality of the regime's response in these protests?
I think I think all of these reasons that we have been talking about, economic reasons, the deep repression that has been, put on Iranian people for so many decades. I think these reasons have always been there. Now, of course, there's an economic collapse in Iran. So that reason has just become one of the biggest reasons now. But people have always been fighting against dictatorship for every reason possible, because the Iranian regime has policed even the most intimate aspects of people's lives, from the way they, get dressed, what they eat, if they dance, if they sing, all of that to the whole political stage where they're not able to assemble. And this is also against, labor rights workers, against union leaders. It has repressed every single person in the society. So, and then the Iranians have shown it again and again and again that they want an end to this, that the regime's time with the Iranian people has long run out. And when every time this type of violence happens, we're always in shock, because I think a part of us still wants to believe that it's not possible that the regime could kill in its own people in this way. But we know that it is possible, not only in Iran, but all over the region. Assad did the same thing. So it's still the same regime. It's the same regime that killed my uncle that's killing all these young people on the streets today.
Sahar, if you can talk about the connection between the anti-war movement, the protests in Iran, and Israel's war on Gaza, the significance of this moment that we are all witnessing, and where President Trump's focus on Iran fits into all of this.
Yeah. So I think one thing that we have to keep in mind is that this level of violence that has happened in Iran is coming after 2 years of genocide. And, the level of violence has just raised so much in our region. And when we see massacre of people all over the region, I think it just shows to us that all of our struggles are connected, that there is no more just one fate of one country that matters. This is all connected. A free Iran must mean a free Palestine, and must mean free Afghanistan, must mean free Syria and Egypt. And I think what we have also witnessed and what history has shown us is that Trump is in no way interested in the Iranian people's well-being and dignity and their rights to live a peaceful, happy, safe life. What they're interested in is just their own interests. That's what they want. Everybody knows that. I think, or if they don't, I mean, if they might pretend like, you know, they buy into this rhetoric of liberation and, but we know what is behind it. We know it because it's happening right before our eyes in Gaza with not one Palestinian being present in you know, shaping their own future. That's going to happen to Iran too, as it has happened to many of the countries that have gone through this sort of military intervention. So I think the anti-war movements and pro-democracy movements, anti-dictatorship movements must go hand in hand.
And if wanted to ask you, you know, Democracy Now, we spoke to the award-winning Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi recently, just last week, in fact, and he said to us that the regime is shattered. It has fallen already politically, ideologically, economically. From any aspect you can imagine, it's fallen. It's only a shell that is in existence, and that also because it's using force. What is your assessment of the strength of this regime? And the fact, as you point out, 1988, when Iran carried out these mass executions, 1988 was the year that an 8-year war with Iran and Iraq ended. And to what extent you think the overall threats against Iran, what role do they play now in these mass executions? In other words, is there a relationship between war, I mean, the country being under siege or the regime, and its response internally?
Of course. I think all of these wars and threats of wars and foreign intervention, what it does is that it really solidifies the core, the hard core of the regime. They are, because they are put in a corner, it makes them unleash violence even more. It gives them sort of this green light, this permit to unleash as much terror as they want. And second is that wars and these sort of interventions, what they do is not necessarily when, you know, Israel attacked Iran in June, it wasn't necessarily weakening the regime. It was weakening a civil society. It was weakening this painful, slow labor of building power under surveillance and persecution. So I think what is important to always realize that Israel is interested in a weak Iranian civil society, as is Iran, as is the Iranian regime. And I think one thing I would like to add to what Jafar Panahi said is that the Iranian regime must lose any legitimacy it has, you know, in international eyes. The Iranian regime is not wanted by the people. And we must realize that this is a dictatorial force. And it is, you know, is not a legitimate, anymore a legitimate governing force.
Sahar Delajani, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Internationally acclaimed Iranian author, and you mentioned Jafar Panahi, and we're going to talk about him right now in the Oscar nominations. The 2026 Oscar nominations have just been released. Nominees include several films we've covered on Democracy Now! Ryan Coogler's film Sinners has been nominated for a record-breaking 16 times, including for Best Director and Best Picture. Also, Delroy Lindo for Best Supporting Actor and Michael Jordan. You can go to our website, Ryan Coogler's interview with us. Other Oscar nominees include The Voice of Hinderjab and It Was Just an Accident for Best International Feature Film, Jafar Panahi's film, and also for Short Film, Armed Only with a Camera, The Life and Death of Brent Renaud, for Best Short Documentary. You can visit democracynow.org to see our segments on all of these films. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.